Yes, hello, folks. Welcome to the weekly Manchester United podcast. I'm your host, as always, Phil Brown, joined with my sparring partner here, the excellent James Rhodes. He's about to spend an hour telling me why I'm wrong about Michael Olise, I would assume. How you doing, mate? How was your weekend?
Yeah, it was pretty good overall. Same as last weekend. It feels like Groundhog Day a little bit on some of these things.
Yeah, you can still imagine before the game starts, couldn't you?
Exactly. But coaching again, got some more sun, so that was nice. All those kind of things. And otherwise, business as usual, isn't it?
Yes, very much. So, you know, it's interesting because I often wonder what it feels like to be supporting a mid-table team where you play a significant number of games that don't have anything at stake. And I know how it feels. And it's a terrible feeling. I don't like it where even the win feels kind of indifferent because there's really no reward at the end of it. And when Burnley equalised at the weekend and he gave him a penalty, my only question was how it would happen and when it would happen. Because I've never seen a football team in my life who can find a way to lose any game, throw away any lead, do something unbelievably stupid like this football team.
I know. And it feels like every time you're struggling with that, because it does feel like a mid-table team. You know, you beat Sheffield United and you think it was a rough one even getting there. You draw against Burnley and you're sort of like, well, it is. It's interesting because I imagine as a mid-table club, when you get into the second half of the season, you're thinking, I'd like to see improvement. I'd like to see growth so that maybe next season we push into that top half, push into something, you know. Something different, make sure we're not threat of relegation, all those types of things. And it's kind of the same here. The points don't matter so much at this point in time. And otherwise, it's just making painful 90 minutes out of things that should be fairly routine, which just doesn't feel very good. It's almost a bit boring, even though there's a lot happening on the pitch back and forth at this point in time.
In the last week, you know, they played Coventry, Burnley and Sheffield United, and actually they've won one of them. Because obviously the Coventry was penalties.
Yep.
Those are pretty much three championship teams. Yep. And it took Coventry 20 minutes of a change of tactics to score three goals against United to come back into the game. Sheffield United, predictably, an unbelievable mistake leads to the first goal. The second goal is a goal we've been seeing all season, same moment, same everything. Within 5 minutes, the second half of the restart always happens, right? Ball down the line, pull back, bang, goal, right? And what we saw against Burnley was, okay, who's going to make the mistake to give the penalty away to throw this game away? I swear to God, I said this to myself. In a couple of minutes later, Onana, I don't even know why he did it, because Wan-Bissaka's dealing with the ball. He doesn't need to come. And ironically, in that game, he played really well. He pulled off some fantastic saves. And this is always the issue with everything with United. There's always a competing statistic, a competing narrative to give you a different perspective on what you're seeing. I mean, Onana pulled off a save in that game, maybe one of the saves of the season. Unbelievable. Yep. And then does something unbelievably reckless. I mean, you're sitting there going, just don't do anything stupid. If Burnley score a Wordley, fine. But do not do anything stupid. Do not give a penalty away that doesn't need to. If he's the last man who goes around you and he's going to tap a ball in, fine, take it. But there's no like, who was it he hit? Audible, was it Audible he hit? There's no danger. Saka's clearing the ball. Why do you have to come?
Yeah.
It's just, and, you know, I would also argue that, and I don't like doing this, but United are on the wrong end of some seriously bad decisions. And I knew when Keir Starmer was asked to comment, you know, last week about Coventry's penalty or offside, this was going to result in United not getting another righteous decisions. You could easily argue that Garnacho's is a penalty, and I'm sorry, but Anthony's is a penalty. If Wan-Bissaka's is a penalty,
yeah. My perspective on it was that I don't think Wan-Bissaka's was a penalty, and I don't think Anthony's was a penalty, because I think those are the ones you don't want to see where a player's defending in a natural position and they call it.
Whatever decision you come to, one will have to come it, from the other, right? And if one's not a penalty, they're both not a penalty. But if one is, then the other one is.
Right, and it just speaks to the inconsistency in the refereeing, because obviously I think the referee's right not to call it.
Mm.
But a different referee called it the other day, and that is a problem. How do you get that consistency? You know, this referee shouldn't call it a penalty if it's not, because somebody else did earlier. The same as if we got something in our favor before, we shouldn't be penalized by a different referee later. It's a mess, and it is the biggest problem, I think, with officiating overall, is that they've always made mistakes, but it's incredibly inconsistent to where you just don't even know what the rule is anymore on many of these things, because it's like one way it's the other, one way it's the other. And I don't think it can come across. And I think there have been times where there's probably been, you know, there's a focus on certain things, right? Like, you know, we did probably get away with it against Wolves in week one, right? That Onana one. We did get away with it. It was for sure a penalty.
That's a penalty.
Exactly. But then we took a beating on a bunch of calls right after that. Anyway, it's just a mess. It is a mess. It's frustrating. And I think it's frustrating for everybody, because you see it in the Spurs-Arsenal game. You saw the same kind of things happening where the Spurs probably felt.
The FA Cup last week, Greg, same handball. Yesterday in the Forest game, right, same thing. It's like, I want to say something. I'm going to, this may be a bit controversial. I'm going to defend referees a bit. And I think that if you look at football, we have technology on things like goal line technology. And nobody ever argues that we should get rid of goal line technology.
Yes.
It has been an incontrovertible success, because that's an objective decision. The ball's either over the line or it's not, right?
Yep.
And when you take football and what normally be an instinctive decision, and there's, you know, within an instinctive decision, maybe you've got a 70% accuracy ratio. But once you stop and freeze frame that and break this high-speed variance game down into a fractal, and then you have someone else looking at the screen, and then there's another 2-3 minutes elapsed, and the referee has to go look to a screen. Like any human being would in that situation, neither being influenced by lots of other variables. How important is this in the context of the game? What's my relationship like with this manager? What decisions have I given before? What's going to be the reaction to the media?
Mm-hmm.
All these things now start influencing how referees think. So, of course, you're going to get inconsistency when you start introducing more details, because referees, no human beings, psychiatry is littered with the replication crisis where they can't repeat human behavior in the same conditions over and over again because they're influenced by so many other things.
Yep.
This is why one decision makes no sense and the other one is given, because they, just like every other human being, are considering all the other influential factors and given that decision. And this was proven, James, whenever it was Anthony Taylor against Spurs, Chelsea, and what was his name, doing the VAR, and said, I didn't want to get my mate in trouble last year. Forget his name. Anyway, I can't believe I forgot his name.
Was it Mike Dean? Was Mike Dean involved?
Yeah, Mike Dean.
Yeah.
Turned around and said, I didn't want to give the decision because I felt, I just solidarity with my colleague, and this, don't be getting upset, because that's exactly what you should expect with VAR, with taking these highly instinctive decisions and then freeze framing it. And now, as any human being would, they're going to consider all these other variables, and that's why they're never called the same.
Yeah, agreed. And it's, I think it shows up worse in the league setting, where you have the same officials regularly, the same VAR regularly, with seeing teams tons and tons of times per year. Because it's interesting, when they take these officials from different countries and they put them all together in the UEFA competitions, I tend to have very few complaints with the officiating on the whole.
I was just going to say this for this reason, because they're not in the bubble.
There's much, it's separate. It's much more independent of each team, of each situation. And so the decisions usually come across pretty logical and pretty well managed, in my opinion. I think the UEFA competitions have been pretty good overall for VAR. I rarely walk away from a game thinking that was, the officials ruined this game or they messed it up. We've seen amazing games this year so far, some of the best we've seen in a long time. I can't remember the officials having an effect on the outcome of any of them. None of it sticks in my mind. And I think that that is a serious factor is you with the, it's much more of an independent body when it comes to these teams from all these different countries and refs from different countries. And you have an English official with a Spanish team and a German team. And it's like, there's nothing there that influences them beyond pure, you know, a pure objective decision. And you like to say they should be able to do that all the time, but nobody does. Nobody can make purely objective decisions all the time. It's just impossible. So, it is a tricky issue. It's probably why, you know, the answer to a lot of it, it's not a problem with VAR necessarily as a tool, but a problem of, you know, application. Should you have a much bigger body of officials and VAR that are totally independent from each other? They don't know each other. They rotate really regularly through the whole of Europe, where you're not seeing the team more than once or twice a year at most, and you don't have these same kind of factors. I mean, they have to figure out probably a better solution to that, just for the you know, the sanctity of the game in general. You have it's just a problem. It just becomes problematic.
I honestly, I don't think any of this technology is helping referees. I think the fact that they've massively over-nuanced the rules and the technology, and the fact that it takes 2-3 minutes to debate this. And I mean, if you're a referee in that situation, I would, you all week you've had your reputation destroyed on the media, and you know, Sky Sports have been, you know, conducting interviews beyond the grave to get their opinion on this, and you know, Alan Shearer, who's completely a liability to the whole argument of having somebody who is impartial, because the guy is completely incapable of being anything other than a Newcastle fanatic and hating United. I mean, his match of the day, you know, come during these penalties, is embarrassing, quite frankly. And for a guy who has such a, you know, committed sense of fairness, so he seems to, the Newcastle owners seem to escape his attention. This is unacceptable. I mean, to me, because the referee last week in the Coventry game, you know, these guys are getting destroyed. I mean, refereeing United, the consequence of giving a decision against them, you know, is far less than the consequence of giving a decision for them. And this has happened way too many times this season, where United have come out on the wrong end of the decision. And when, if they ever do come out on the right end, you're not allowed to forget it, and no question about it, it influences referees in a human way, not in a way where, you know, they have deliberate intention to, you know, to be, I'm not questioning integrity, I just think it's a very difficult job, and VAR is actually making it harder. I understand why they did it, but it must be a nightmare for a referee, man.
Yeah, I agree. And if it was fixing up just like these huge, massive errors on game-changing moments that exist, like, you know, the handball goals type of thing.
Yes,
that happen, well, like these massive moments, that would make sense. Doesn't affect the game. I like automated offsides. I understand it. In UEFA, again, it's quicker, it's faster, it's objective. There's no weird
with
lines. It's just, this is what it is. It's the same as the goal line tech. So the more they can move in that direction, where they are objective, machine-made decisions, if they're interfering with the game, good. Otherwise, less interference. I mean, even just taking less things to VAR and sticking with whatever was called in a moment on the pitch probably helps the situation a bit more too.
All right, let's stick to the Burnley game. 47% possession. They surrendered possession stats to Burnley. I've probably said bits and pieces before on United, but I'm looking at this United team. To me, there's a lot of things that make perfect sense. You know, this United team is playing the way Solskjaer's United team played pre-Bruno Fernandes. Mm-hmm. And they're forced to do that because they don't have the pace in the back four. They can't play a high pressing line, so they have to sit there. And there's big gaps between the defence and the midfield and the forward line because of the fact that defence are trying to play a low block counter-attack. So they're asking teams to come on to them so that they can hit them on the counter-attack, find spaces and score. They can't control possession because they can only play one way. They always have to sit deep. But of course, when you're inviting teams onto you, there's a much higher probability you're going to make a mistake, concede a goal, concede all these chances. But you never have to do that because they can't control a game of football. One of the reasons why Ten Hag was happy to sell Maguire last season was because it was lack of pace. And he wanted a defender in there that had, you know, that gave him the ability to play a higher line. Maguire was excellent in Solskjaer's counter-attacking team. He was excellent in Leicester's counter-attacking team. And you can see when United play high, whether it's Maguire, Casemiro, Varane, how easy they are done in behind if they get attacked that way. I mean, you even saw it against Coventry, because Coventry sat deep, and there was a couple of times when they knocked along in the channels and they were getting ruined for pace. So I think this is a big problem for how United want to play. And I think the other thing that is a big concern for me, where I think Ten Hag really needs to face some question over, is Rasmus Højlund. I can understand why Weghorst was popular, because he dropped deep, his link-up play was great, and you could see how important that was for the likes of Rashford on the wings, because the space was there when the centre-backs followed Weghorst out to score. Every single chance that fell centrally to United the weekend, and they have many, fell to Garnacho or fell to Antony. If I'm Højlund, I'm screaming at both of them. Like, get out of my position. You're not fighting Højlund on the left wing, I'm fighting him on the right wing. It's so they're essentially on top of him, where he's competing for the same ball with his own players rather than Burnley. 25 minutes to go in your only striker in a football club is being taken off when you need a goal. That is a big concern for me. I don't know how you get Rasmus Højlund into this United team. The stat was Onana passing the ball more times than any other player. I think Michael Cox done a review on how many times he gets the ball from Bruno Fernandes. And he's playing with wing, which was like one of the lowest in the league. And he's playing with wingers that really aren't providers. They want to score.
Mm-hmm.
They bring on Ahmad because Ahmad sits deeper, right? I'm like, this is a consequence of a direct tactic that Ten Hag is asking them to play. Lastly, then when you see teams attack, those two wingers are really narrow. So the space that the fullbacks have to attack United, and, you know, two-on-ones, you know, constantly being caught. How many times have we seen United concede goals from the wingers not tracking back? Partly mm-hmm. because they're so narrow, because when the other teams break quickly, they're not in those positions. I would have serious concerns about that.
Yeah, I think it's in general one of the biggest concerns that we've had is that, you know, I think one of the biggest critiques under Solskjaer way back when was in being unable to kind of organize those attacking patterns that would create a lot of chances for your striker and these types of things. And it hasn't really changed that much in years now. We've had a pretty consistent front three, maybe the only area we've had some consistency for some time over the course of the season, because, you know, Rashford, Garnacho, Antony, and Højlund have been pretty much all healthy since about the fourth, fifth week, I think, after Arsenal, right? When Højlund came on for the first time and then he began to start games since then. They've all been pretty available. And I don't really see, as you described, any sort of consistent way to make chances for the striker or for the striker to get involved. And it's interesting, in the last few games, Højlund's average position has been deeper to where he's actually almost behind the center midfielder exactly. At this point in time on average. And it's because you're trying to somehow get in the game and get involved, because there's nothing happening when he's sitting up top. It's not going to him. Nothing's happening there. And Garnacho, I think, on average position, which is very normal for United, whoever's playing on that left wing, it's the same. You look at the average position of the team, they're 20 yards ahead of everybody else on that left wing, because they're usually leading the attack from the left, you know, looking forward for the break and staying high or up to provide kind of that outlet for the team when the pressure comes in and they get the ball back to be able to kind of launch it through and send them through. But it's not getting to the striker, and I don't see why it ever will with how we're playing. I don't see any solution to it with what's happening. I don't see any even attempts, you know, for it, you know.
Mate, and this is exactly my issue with Olise. It's not that he isn't a top player. It's not that he wouldn't beat I just don't know, how do you get him in a position where you have a different outcome than what you're having right now? Because even if you are a creative winger, right, the positions that you're occupying and you're picking the ball up, you're not going to cross the ball to Rasmus Højlund, right? At best, you're going to squirt. And you're going to be 2-3 feet away, right? And so, you know, I look at the positions that Højlund's occupying. I mean, Fernandez is leading the press, right? Mm-hmm. United don't really have that high press team because of the way their defense is. So it's not really a team that can play a high press because they don't have the players to do it. I noticed that he put Wan-Bissaka on the right again at Sheffield United and at Burnley. Yeah. There's a major problem because if your wingers are going to tuck in, your fullbacks have to get down the line, right? And Wan-Bissaka isn't a good enough footballer to give you an option on the right as an attacker. So yep. This constantly gives you your right winger a problem. And it's the same on the left, you know, because if you look at, go back even as far as Memphis Depay. Memphis Depay's best form on the left came when Luke Shaw's best form came, right? I remember him having a really great period for a while when Shaw came back, you know, and then when Shaw got injured, Depay's form fell off a cliff. And same thing on the left. With no left back, it's a major, major problem because they don't have an attacking option on the left. It makes United really, really one-dimensional. Now, yeah. There's a lot of things that I've said before, like, you know, a brilliant stat from Carl Anka in the fantastic Talk of the Devils podcast last week. This was, you know, this was also telling that United have given more minutes to teenagers in the Premier League than the top six combined this season. Mm-hmm. That's a consequence of squad depth, right? And I think what I would also say is you've seen Mane's energy levels just drop a little bit the last few weeks, which is entirely normal. This is exactly what you should expect. And United obviously bring a lot, you know, if United fans aren't happy, but one of the biggest indicators of injury is massive load change. And United have to manage this really, really carefully because if they have to have any prayer against City or anything, they're going to need Mane fit. They're going to need these players fit. But James, I still have major concerns about the fact that no Ten Hag's United team has ever been able to get a central striker in a game. And we're talking about banning another central striker. Mm-hmm. It's going to be the same thing.
Yeah, and I wonder about that because, you know, I look at and that's my thing, right, is I take it and I say, when I talk about a creative winger, I'm saying something has to change because I think somehow we have to have that and we have to change how we attack where that person will become useful. But I don't think we have anybody in the squad good enough at that at the moment. So, yeah, Olise comes into this team now. He's not going to do any better with how it's playing at the moment. But I think to move forward, we need a player of that with those attributes and to change the way we're attacking. And I agree with you in a sense. When I look at some of the things that are said about, you know, like a striker's a priority to buy another central striker, I look at that and I think, what are they going to do any different? What are they going to do to improve it? Maybe Harry Kane could come into this team and play a bit differently because he has, of course, you know, some of the elite creative traits of coming deeper and doing things and all of that. How many times is he going to get the ball if he were to come into this team right now in order to do that? That's also a rare breed. I mean, Harry Kane may be one of the most complete strikers we've ever seen in many respects. I don't see who we'd be going to buy for a striker that's going to make a difference, that's going to suddenly, you know, change things, you know, in this side. You know, we had Cavani for a year we had him for two, but mostly for 1 year. And I thought he did really, really well. But the team was much more functional at that time, too. I think in a lot of capacities and you had lockdown and you had a lot of different things going on, but I don't see, you know, how a striker changes it for another striker changes it for Højlund. You can give him rest. It's not going to change much. I mean,
this position is dying in football, right? I mean, football goes through different phases, different fashions. You know, Barcelona's number 9 is what, 34, Lewandowski? Real Madrid don't really have a number 9 anymore. PSG played against Barcelona first game with Asensio up there. Arsenal are playing Havertz up there. I mean, Liverpool's number 9 is nowhere near good enough. Darwin Nunez, right?
And he doesn't even play centrally that often anymore. He's often drifting all over the place.
So Haaland is a number nine, but how many others are there? Yeah. And you know, this is part when you play those inverted wingers like that, you know, that number nine is, you know, it's almost irrelevant.
Yeah, and he so, loses space.
Yeah. And I mean, in a team like City, where you create a million chances, you're inevitably going to score goals. But I think we had an hour, Haaland hasn't scored away at any of the top six this season.
And he struggled in the Champions League recently, too.
Yeah, well, against the top teams, you know, in defense of the stat of Bruno finding Rasmus Haaland, it's probably one of the hardest balls to execute in football,
yeah,
right?
Because
it's heavy compact, and these are the areas where teams will not give you space.
Middle to middle is going to be
places where teams won't give you space. Secondly, to be able to pull that off, you can't be a counter-attacking team, right? You have to be able to cut teams open with patterns and rhythms of play and being able to create spaces in behind, and United are just nowhere near doing that. For Haaland, you're going to get frustrated and your confidence is going to get hit very easily in this team. You know, James, I've said this before, obviously Ten Hag's future comes up every week. There are certain things I don't like that I wish he wouldn't do. One, I don't like him coming out after a game saying things like, we're one of the most entertaining, high-intensity teams in the league. I mean, that to me, I understand there's lots of reasons why United are in the mess that they're in. But the one thing he has to have a modicum of self-awareness is that he's also now like a politician campaigning for his job. And he needs to convince fans that this is nowhere near good enough. Van Gaal made this mistake, right? Oh, they all said Louis Van Gaal's red and went on me. Look, right now, you need to convince the fans that what we're seeing looks nothing like what an Erik ten Hag team will actually look like. And this is a concern for me, is even with all these players back, you know, are we still going to be a team that can't get a number nine into a game? I mean, if you look at the goals scored last season, no Rashford. I mean, Ten Hag's stuck in the job. Yeah. And you have to have more than one goal threat. And right now, United don't really have that. I mean, Bruno Fernandes is the top goal scorer in the team.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a major, major concern for me. And Ten Hag needs to really refine his messaging to say, I understand why he doesn't want to criticize individuals, but the team, and say, look, you know, this looks nothing like what my vision is for Manchester United. Turning around and saying stuff like that is criminal to me.
Yeah, my biggest problem is this, and I feel like if you've ever had employees or people who work under you or kids or things like that, you kind of understand this point. I don't know if I've mentioned it before on here, but I feel like I have this kind of a perspective, is that when something's going bad, it's really hard to trust people who say nothing's wrong and will tell you, you know, the way that they respond to you when you talk to them gives you a lot of an impression or faith or trust or whatever you would have in their ability to fix it. And when something is not the way that it seems, and you go to somebody and they say, yeah, you know what, this isn't good enough, this isn't how it should be, I'm going to fix it, you trust them a lot more than the person who brushes it off or says, no, it's fine, it's all good, it's fine. And that's kind of just, I mean, that's just the nature of kind of taking responsibility for it, is you want to see, it almost goes against it, because people get the idea, for whatever reason, that if they admit that something isn't good enough, then it makes them worse than maintaining that it is, and that this is the right way and that this is it. I would have a lot more.
You just have to fix it. The problem is recognizing this.
I would like a lot more brutal honesty without targeting players and things like that, because it doesn't work. But to say, look, this isn't the way we want to play. We are not getting it right. We are not doing the things right each and every week. We are not getting our game plan into effect. It is not happening the way that we want to. This looks nothing like what I want the team to be. I would actually feel a lot more confident hearing that. I think most people would. And you'd get media tearing into somebody for admitting and saying those kinds of things, but it doesn't really matter. From a perspective of fans, I think they appreciate it. You know, it's like you get in the same critiques with players like Marcus Rashford and such. When you pretend nothing's wrong and it's going all okay, people jump on your back a lot more, for the most part. And I think that happens with everybody. And it's just the type of thing. If I go to somebody, you know, and I say this isn't good enough, and they tell me it is, how am I going to know they're going to fix it? How can I say that they're going to fix that and make it better when I'm looking at it and saying it's not good enough? If they're just, you know, if they would just say that it was, I have a lot more trust in them that they can fix it, that something's wrong. And that's my perspective on it. That's kind of mostly what bothers me, like you said about the comments, is if you're saying this is how you want to play, then I have no faith that you know what's wrong and we'll be able to fix it. But if you will say this is not working, then at least I know you're looking at it and saying it's broken. And you can't fix something until you know that it's broken. If you think it's fine, then there's nothing doing. So
yeah,
I agree with you there.
You could definitely come out and say things like, look, I trust my players. I trust their ability. I trust that we'll get it right. Obviously, none of us are happy with where we're at. You know, and there's a million ways of also accepting responsibility yourself. Yeah. So you're not just blaming your players and saying, look, yeah, it's collectively, we're not where we want to be. We're not where we need to be. You know, instead of coming out and saying stuff like that. Because here's the thing. You can be entertaining when you're calamitous. Right.
Yeah.
You know, there's lots of teams could turn around that, you know, start throwing caution to the wind, being wide open. But, you know, they're also trying to win, get results at this level. So being wide open in games, I mean, it took Burnley 20 seconds to have a shot at the weekend. Dadjo Fofano has made me nervous, by the way. He gets a ball in the edge of the box. I'm like, tell me United are not going to go 1-0 down for 20 seconds against Burnley. And a couple of times Burnley are in on goal, and Onana had saved them. And I'm like, you know, this is, I put a tweet out about a week ago saying, I just want to be able to watch United for 90 minutes without shaking my head in disbelief at what I'm watching. And I haven't been able to do that this week, and I thought maybe we'd be safe doing it this week. No disrespect to Burnley. I mean, take a look at some of the results. I mean, I think Arsenal had them for 6 and stuff. City had them for 6. It's like, I look at this and go, and you know, I want this to stop. You know, I, as I said before, I could sit here and say absolutely none of the problems at United are at Ten Hag's fault. Let's just say, be the most generous we could be and say everything that we're seeing right now has nothing to do with Ten Hag. But that's a different question than saying, yeah, but what will an Eric Ten Hag, you know, best Eric Ten Hag team look like? Do we ever see a Ten Hag team that could, you know, win the league? Maybe he could. You know, I know people say United are a million megs win all that there, but what was Arteta, 6th? They finished 6th, I think it was. And then the next year they had the title challenge. Things can change quickly. If you have a cultural change, you bring in the right players. It doesn't, like Ranić was saying, it doesn't have to be 3-4 years away. And quite frankly, if you're a United manager, you have no right to talk like that. And I mean, I feel sorry for him in some sense because he's had very little luck. I mean, now you've got the McTominay injury. And I mean, defensively, it's been a disaster with the number of injuries. I mean, it's truly defies belief. But there's other things that I would have to be honest and say that I am really, really concerned about an Erik ten Hag's team that attacks and how one-dimensional the threat is.
Yeah, for sure. And I agree. It's hard to find... Like you said, there are so many valid reasons you could write it all off. That it's not his fault, the things that have happened. There's so many. You could be very generous and do that.
Yes, I thought you were done that.
No. Yeah, go ahead.
Do you think it's telling that any of us haven't said anything? Because obviously Ten Hag's his job and speculation surrounding his job, you know, is... It's rife, and it's one of the most ubiquitous talking points. You know, it's always brought up. And if I'm Eric Ten Hag, I would want my employer to come out and say his position is completely secure no matter what happens between them. Yeah. Right? I think it's very telling that they haven't done that. And I would be confident in the sense that I think they're right, by the way, not to react to all the anger, right? I think they're right to have a proper process that Jason Wilcox and Barada can sit down and go, okay, these are easily identifiable problems that are Eric Ten Hag's that we can fix. You know, there's an article came out last week, or a comment that came out last week, and it's well-sourced, about Ten Hag's frustration internally with the fact that he doesn't have the proper staff, that he doesn't have the quality of the departments that you need at this level to function at the highest level. But if I'm Eric Ten Hag, mate, and I'm certain that 99% of the problems ignited aren't mine, by the way, it'll take any of us a long time to fix these, and I can fix in the next year or two. I would quickly want to start distancing myself from these failures, because Ten Hag still has the pedigree where if he gets sacked at United, he could go on, recover, and have a great career somewhere else. No question about that. I mean, there's not a lot of great managers out there right now. So for him, it may be a part of him saying, I want to distance myself from this. Because he's going to become defined by these failures. So the question is, one, do you think Ineos should make a statement? And if they do sack him, who do you want? Because this is a big, big question. And do not say deserve it on this podcast.
No, for sure. No, it's interesting. I'll get to that because I think people will be a little surprised by it. But no, I think there's a couple of things that are telling that you could look at without any inside information at all. Okay, in terms of some of the things that have come out in the last week or so. Number one, you have a story from very, very well-sourced James Ducker at The Telegraph about when, as soon as Wilcox arrives, that Eric Ten Hag is on trial and he's being assessed over the last month. Now, in one logical sense, one could look at it and say, can you really assess a manager in 1 month? Doesn't totally make a lot of sense to me. But it does lay the groundwork for the decision being a football-based decision, right? That you have an expert who's there. The first person, remember, this is the first person that Ineos have been able to appoint who's actually arrived on the job, right? Because Omar Barada, even though he's involved, is still on gardening leave. Dan Ashworth is not done. This is the first person Ineos have put into the club. And instantly you get this story. I think that's pretty telling that it lays a lot of the groundwork for the decision to come. And that could be either way, just based on that alone, right? That it's a football decision, that Wilcox has assessed it and said, he's the right guy. He can play how we want to play. He can do what we want to do. It's not his fault. And we're ready to go. Or look at it and say, no, it's not good enough. There's other problems. There's communication issues. It's all well detailed in that article. It lays out kind of the way it could go on both ways quite nicely. But then here's a couple of points that I want to make, some of which just came out today and, well, publicly came out today, but has been a plan for a long time. Ten Hag speaks a lot like we're in the middle of building towards something, you know, that it's progress. Today, United have, well, somebody has briefed quite a number of journalists that pretty much everybody's up for sale and is available. Mm-hmm. That's not the actions of a team that is in the middle of building something, but a team that's about to start over, if you look at it on that way. If you're saying we're only keeping, you know, Kaby Mainoo, Alejandro Garnacho, and Rasmus Højlund, three very young players, only one who has been purchased in the last 5 years of those, because the other ones are youth, of course. Well, I guess Garnacho was, but from the youth level. You're not saying we're building something, we've got a core team here that we're going to keep progressing on. You're saying we're okay with anybody leaving except those three because they're young, they have great value, and they have a great future, and they could probably fit into whatever we want to do moving forward. That doesn't, from an outside perspective, speak to me of a continuation of a project, your favorite word. It does not speak to me of a continuation of a project, but rather a starting over, okay? Let's say a building, it speaks to me that you're starting over, you're leveling the playing field, because if you're continuing, you would at least have some core players. You'd be thinking, yeah, that's someone we're building off of. That's someone we're continuing to work with. They're kind of saying, whoever we could get out, they'll be gone. And then we'll figure out what we need. That sounds like starting over from that perspective. So from the outside, you could look at it in many different ways and come to conclusions. You also have the story, you know, today from someone that, you know, Ajax would like to bring Ten Hag back, that his decision again will not be announced until after the final. And I still sit there and think, if he's staying, why can't you say it now? Mm-hmm. And give some confidence ahead of the FA Cup. You know, then the players they know there's going to be the same manager. And it to me, from totally outside perspective, it is pretty telling, like we've talked about before, that he hasn't got this backing. It's sort of like, is it going to be made off of winning or losing the FA Cup final? I can't see that being logical. I can't see that being the way people like this would operate.
Yeah, and here's the thing, James, right? Ineos will be well aware of all the internal feelings at this point that you could easily say are causal of why United are in a situation. So they will have been able to take all that information into consideration. And if they felt that, you know what, this is the 99% of the reason why we're feeling, then it's easy to come to a decision and say, we're going to support it. If you are saying that, that's not enough of a reason. We have to. I mean, I don't care if United win every game between now and the end of the season and win it 5-0. It doesn't change what we know right now. And even if I'm never confident in going into a game of football.
Yeah.
My honest belief, as I've said before, is once United get injuries to a few key players, they're really not a top four team. Right, just like Newcastle, yeah. Right? You could, if everyone stays fit, you know, key players stay fit, then they're a major chance. But there's four better teams in the Premier League than United, right? That's just a fact to me, especially once they get injuries, right? So it's not a massive surprise to me they're in sixth. But as usual with everything, it's high and why they're in sixth. I mean, there's United have to make a commitment at nine. Because it's not just Ten Hag's future, it's Sancho's, right? It's, you know, a whole host of players at United who their decision and what they do with their future is going to be determined by what happens with the manager. You have the Euros, right? I think you have a Copa America this summer too. So I'm not 100% sure, I might be that wrong, but I know we've international tournaments this summer. So it's going to be a truncated summer because you're going to have to operate with all the restrictions on those. So this is just where really
the Copa America is this summer as well. Yeah.
So really you have to get a head start now on your summer business. And you know, whoever's going to be signing for Manchester United or even in United are pursuing, you know, the manager who are they playing for is going to be a key factor in this. So I don't understand where, if any of us were to turn around and say, we're making a change at the end of the season, just like Barcelona did, just like Bayern Munich did, and I know Xavi went back on his word, and they've changed that. I give Ten Hag the opportunity to see out the season. Look, you might win another FA Cup, that's fine, we're going to make the change. But if you're going to make it based on the next few games, to me that's a bit flimsy, you know, because anyone can put a run form together and lose a couple of games. I need more than that.
Yeah, and I've never thought that was the case from the information that I had that it was based on this. And I'll give you a little bit of an example of this, right? A while back, you did get a lot of articles about the results being a major factor in Ten Hag's future. Well, that's over. The results have been horrific.
Yeah.
So if that was all true and it was just based on results, he'd already be sacked. I don't think that was ever really the case. I think there's a big picture that goes into all of this, down to whether he stays in the job or not. And it's not going to be based on the results of the next few weeks. That's my opinion on it. Now, you asked who would I like and some talk about De Zerbi. And I wonder, the only thing I wonder, and I don't know if this is reasonable. I don't know that this is true. This is 100% a speculative thing that I'm saying here. Okay. This is purely opinion. So don't take it as anything else. But, is it reasonable to say someone isn't the right manager, but you don't have better options available? And that's why I'm asking, because I'm saying, like, let's say you were to rank all the managers you could get and Ten Hag falls somewhere in the middle and you miss out on all the top ones. What do? Do you get someone you think might be worse because you think Ten Hag isn't the guy? Probably, to be fair, you might just have to anyway. I've sort of mentioned it before. You know, if you've decided that you're not going to be with your wife anymore and you've told her that, then, you know, you're kind of out of options at that point in time. But to go out there and try your luck with whoever you can. but I look at it and I am a little worried about it.
Tell me, Timsy.
I am almost... Not the strategy, not a recommended strategy in the slightest, not at all.
True, Greg. Oh, geez, you're around my camera soon, getting in the air car.
No, but in terms of the options, right? So you look at Liverpool went through a whole bunch of things before the settling on Arnie Slot from the Dutch league. We'll see how that works out, right? They passed up on Ruben Amorim, who was definitely someone they considered. You know, Xavi's staying at Barcelona. So it's kind of sorted itself a little bit. Xabi Alonso is staying at Leverkusen. So some of the best candidates out there have kind of settled now at this point. And the market that once looked a little bit hectic for managers is actually kind of calm at the moment, because Bayern are Bayern. You know, Nagelsmann has said he's staying with the German team. So what are your options now? When you look at it, I would say, of course, you have Thomas Tuchel is one that's been talked about a lot recently. You still have Graham Potter, who exists, and you can't take that away. You have a talk about Roberto De Zerbi for many different reasons. You've got Ruben Amorim, who's obviously been of interest to a lot of English clubs. You have others like, I'll probably butcher this pronouncement, but Lopetegui from Spain, yeah, who West Ham are looking at as well. Pablo Fonseca. Yeah. You have Thiago Mota. What's that?
I think AC Milan are looking at Lopetegui too. But
yeah, you have Thiago Mota, who's probably going to Juventus. I don't think anyone's going to hire Allegri from one of the big clubs. But, you know, so there's options. Me personally, talk about De Zerbi specifically, because you wanted my opinion on that. I have the exact same problems with De Zerbi that I do with Ten Hag, almost identical. I think he's... been really rigid with certain things. I feel like his system maybe works in ideal conditions that have to be perfect, and outside of that, there's not much adaptability. I think it's been really bad. The results for Brighton, I think, are it's Brighton, you know, but at the same time, it's been really bad the last few months. And it's a tough argument. I don't know a ton about him, but every time I've watched him, I've thought I see a lot of the same issues. I see an open midfield. I see conceding a lot of chances. I see, you know, I talked with somebody and they said, look, you take people like Pep Guardiola, Xabi Alonso, what makes them really good aside from their system is they problem solve. Also, they figure out if something is an issue, how to fix it. And then you have managers who are way too rigid in that don't fix it. And I think that's where De Zerbi falls for me now. And I think he'd have a really hard time at United. I think it could go really poorly. I think of the people discussed, I would still choose someone like Ruben Amorim simply because it has its risks. There's no doubt about that. I'm not saying it's not risky. It's risky. But he's doing really well. He's done really well at Sporting. He's done it for 5 years now, basically. Has had a team ripped up a lot. So he's had to problem solve in terms of his team, because they sell, you know, in Portugal, your team is not the same every year to year. It's a good physical league. He's done well in that respect. He's a good personality. He has a lot of confidence. He's got a lot of personality. I think there's a lot of positives to him. There's no guarantee in it, but I think he's somebody you could say, yeah, we're going to build a young team with this guy. And it would be a good choice for that. That'd probably be my top choice of the people available. To say there's a lot of upside to someone like that, and you know, there's risks with everybody, but there's a lot of upside.
Yeah, I mean, look, if I was, you know, going to be kind to De Zerbi, I would have to give him the same charity that I'm giving Ten Hag, and that he's had a lot of injuries too. You know, Brighton have had a lot of injuries, and you know, the difference between Pep and De Zerbi is, you know, Pep can go to players and go to a squad that he's been building for years, where he has an almost like-for-like replacement. I mean, some of the players on City's bench are unbelievable. You know, Matheus Nunes, who you never even hear about. You know, the Calvin Phillips wasn't getting the game. You know, they have ridiculous depth that they can rotate to, where De Zerbi doesn't have that. And so, inevitably, when you lose key players, you know, you can't play the way you want to play. So I'd have to give De Zerbi some, you know, mitigation there and say that, if Brighton get a couple, 4 or 5 injuries, they're a mid-table team, which is fair, right? You know, if everyone stays fit, you know, then fine. It would concern me a little bit that pretty much since October, they've stalled. And their young players haven't been, You know, Evan Ferguson, always out for the rest of the season, you know, hasn't scored since Forest away in January. You know, a lot of the young players, second half of the season, did not progress. And I know that you and I had a conversation about this a long time ago, about the fact that Brighton, in their training, they just do recovery. They don't do a lot of work in, you know, training Monday to Friday. And so it's interesting that maybe their energy levels are dropping off. I don't know. But I'm not saying De Zerbi isn't a top manager. I just don't know. And I don't know has he done enough to get a Manchester United job? Personally, you know, you have to be careful. You know, Spurs fans tweeting at the weekend, Ange out. Right? This is how quickly it turns. You know, it only takes a couple of injuries to key players for teams that are just scraping top four for it to look terrible. So to me, it's like, I don't know. I don't have an obvious answer. And if there was another manager at Manchester United going through exactly the same thing that Ten Hag's going through, would it look that much differently? What I will say is this. Time has spoken for a lot of United managers. And my opinion on what the job that Mourinho did at United has changed a bit. Right? Mm-hmm. Be a bit more charitable to Mourinho. But you'll have to say the same of Solskjaer too. I mean, Solskjaer truthfully done a fantastic job at United. The last season, of course, it came apart as it did for everyone else. But Ten Hag, you know, if he wins the FA Cup and he gets sacked, I would say he's pretty unlucky, considering, you know, what he's had to deal with and the budget cuts United have gone through. But what I'm afraid of happening, James, is United going out this summer, backing him, 7 or 8 new players, and then sitting in October exactly where we are right now.
I agree. It is tricky because if we do that, like I said, I think we talked about this before. If you go out and you say, give him another chance, then you have to spend a lot of money this summer to rebuild this team and fix the problems that he's having. And if you have to then, if it goes poorly and you sack him in December, November, you're screwed. You wasted a whole nother year and a whole lot of money, and you have no idea what you're going to do then. And part of the reason where I don't accept the argument, you know, like I asked at the beginning, sort of semi-rhetorically, is it reasonable to say that maybe we don't have better options, so we'll stick with Ten Hag? But my question on that is, when are you ever going to definitively have better manager options available? Yeah. Because I don't see who is definitively better. I mean, the manager pool is tiny in terms of really top managers. It is literally 2, maybe 3, right? You have to say, right? You have Pep Guardiola, Jurgen Klopp, I don't know, and he's pretty much retiring at the moment for a while, and Ancelotti, and then what? Who could you really say is top?
I mean, Bayern's had this problem too. Look at they're looking at, it's like, you know,
they're looking at Ralf Rangnick as practically an interim for a year until they find somebody. But who's it going to be? Xabi Alonso, right? But where's he going to go? Well, he's probably going to replace Ancelotti in Madrid in a few years. That's why he's sticking around. So what are you going to do? You're not going to have what are the better options next summer? And so that's why I do think it's stick or twist now. It's stick for the long haul or twist and go a different direction at the moment. And anything else, I think, would be a bit of cowardice, in my opinion. If they do not stick with something from here forward and really commit to it, I think it would be a mistake. I think it'd be a big mistake in that respect. And that would include if they were to just say, we'll just see how Ten Hag does for another year. I think that's a huge mistake. I think if you decide he's the guy, then decide he's the guy, because you're going to need to do a lot to fix it, and it's going to take a while. So give him a 2-year plus one contract, give him a couple more years and stick with it if that's what you're deciding. But I think going in and saying, we'll see one more year, we haven't triggered his option, by January he's looking for jobs, then you're already finished at that point. It makes no sense to me. So either way, you know, I think they really have to commit to it, and at this point one can make their own assessments based on what's out there as to what they're doing, but you know, they have to. I think that would be the biggest worry I have, is that I wouldn't commit to doing anything and just keep doing a bit of a halfway job. They're not immune to criticism for me. They really aren't, despite, you know, everything.
Well, and they're in this position now where, you know, they've got a bunch of freebies so far. You know, you can't go wrong appointing an Omar Barada. You can't go wrong appointing a Dan Ashworth. You can't go wrong appointing a Jason Wilcox. They're easy, you know. But when you start making football decisions that affect how you need to play on the pitch, I mean, any OSS decision they have to get right. You know, you said something the other day about Arne Slot, which was entirely correct in that, one, you can never have certainty when appointing someone, right? Because there's always more, there's always something else you can consider. And the fact that Liverpool went for Arne Slot is an indication of the dearth of top quality guys out there. And, you know, this is where it gets hard. I think data is really, really helpful, giving you logical inferences when it comes to, you know, how does, like, where I think it has tremendous utility, James, where, you know, it's hard to be, erudite or, you know, on social media because it's just not the platform for that. But when you look at how a team plays, right? I mean, you can look at, okay, you know, how many times they dominate possession, you know, attacks, all that, you know, there's a lot you can tell from a manager about how they want to play because the same stats will show up every week. The things that Liverpool will find it hard to replicate is the pressure, the focus, the scrutiny. You know, different players have completely different environments. You know, if you've got, you know, your striker, Farinoy doing what Salah did, you can deal with them easily, but not so much at Liverpool. And these are the things you find really, really difficult to put on a data sheet because the variables are totally different. And that's the thing is, like, you know, for someone like a Ruben Amorim or someone like a De Zerbi to survive at United, they have to have a rock solid team behind them that completely supports them, that says, you know, we're not going to let players come to us and say we want this guy out after 6 months. The problem with this is one of the things they're going to realize, mate, is, and you know, Barada has never had this type of focus, is this pressure to make a change, if it doesn't go well, will be unlike anything they've ever experienced. And that's a factor. So I don't know what the right thing is to do, but it's a decision they have to make now. Look, if they'd say we're moving out and have gone at the end of the season, I wouldn't shed a single tear. I've tried to be really balanced with him. I've spoken to a lot of my friends that who were Ten Hag, you know, and indifferent that are now certain he needs to go. And I listen to him. It's like, I completely understand the argument. I hear the alternative. I understand that too. And it all depends what day you ask me to get my feelings on it. Usually in the immediate aftermath of games, I'm just so pissed off with what I'm watching. I just want to scream. I don't care how you do it. Just make it stop.
Yeah, I know. And that's where it is it's like, it's just at that point where you can't, it's hard to argue against the idea that just you have to make change, even if for change's sake at this point, because it can't continue to go on the way that it is. It's certainly, obviously, the biggest question of the whole, of everything now leading up to it. The next few weeks are probably not going to be that instructive as to anything. You know, it's a bit of a holding pattern until the FA Cup final, right? It's sort of a, I guess, whatever happens, happens type of thing until the FA Cup final. I think it's a big importance at the same time from Ineos leadership that United are in some sort of European competition. You need the games and you need the revenue. And it could cause serious problems. And then obviously, sort of in tangent to this, when you start getting these briefs about all the players being available, you kind of know the season's over because you don't want to say those types of things. I put this out on a video back on February 15th that this was the case, even with the exact same three players named that were pretty much safe about the situation, because this has been this way for a long time. But it is instructive to note that when it's being put out and it goes through these multiple very good journalists who have close ties to the club, someone is basically saying we're okay with it being out there now. We're okay with it being out there, and in some respects, putting the shop window up and saying, you want anybody on our team, come and get them now. We're open to it. You could start dialogue with them and their agents. You can start dialogue with us, and let's start seeing what happens. And now is kind of that that time. Could that affect things?
I have to believe that Bruno Fernandes is not one of those who's in that discussion forgettable. I can't even imagine what United would look like without Bruno Fernandes.
I hear you. I hear you. And I don't disagree. And this isn't meant to be in the slightest disrespect to Bruno, because he's one of my favorite players, probably since the Sir Alex time, easily, that we've brought in and has been playing. One of my favorites by far. He's played a lot of minutes, has a lot of miles, and is getting older from a football perspective. And if you're looking at the next 5 years and saying, is he going to be the same player in 3 years or 4 years or 5 years from now? Probably not. It's hard to say whether he is or he isn't. Is he the type of player where he needs to be a focal point of the team in order to be productive? Probably. And you'd have the same question to some degree about Marcus Rashford and his, you know, he's not in terms of age, but in terms of being a focal point, someone you need to kind of to some degree build the team around to get them the most out of them, to get the best out of them. I think those have to be considerations. And that's part of where, you know, the point I was saying earlier, where I say, if you're saying all these players are available, and yeah, it would take big offers. So I'm not selling Bruno for 30 million or 40 million. You're talking a very large fee for players like that. But if you're making them available in a respect where if they wanted to go and the money came in, then you're saying where we go in the future may not look the same. And we really are starting over. And so, yeah, I can't really imagine what it would look like. You know, if we get into next season and there was no Bruno, no Rashford, you know, no Maguire, not to put them all on the same level, but, you know, no Maguire. And, you know, what would the team look like? I have no idea at this point in time. No Casemiro. I have no idea what it would look like. I have no idea what we'd even be doing. I wouldn't be able to sit there and tell you this is how we're going to play. This is the way we're going to operate. This is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to score goals. You'd have no clue until you actually watch us play football. I think that is a possibility. I don't think most of those players are going to be sold. I think it's really unlikely that come the end of the window that Rashford, Bruno are sold. I think they're both probably going to be here still. But I'm just saying, when you kind of look at the perspective of it, it sheds maybe a little bit of light on the future.
To me, my opinion is United shouldn't be looking to sell players the minute they turn 30. Because
I agree with that.
Luka Modric, Real Madrid, was one of the midfield at 35, 36. His value to Real Madrid on the pitch far exceeded anything they would get from selling him. You know, United want to run the football club like, you know, we're just a farm place. When once players reach a certain level of maturity, we're going to sell them. And because not, you know, making a profit on our players is more important than anything else.
Yeah.
Bruno Fernandes, to me, is one of the few problems that don't need fixing, if you mean. He's not a problem. There's no solution to me needed there. And, you know, if you want to bring in someone like John Neves, and, you know, grow him into that position, fine. But trying to replace Bruno Fernandes with someone that's on a similar level, even if they're young. I mean, if you're going to sign young Neves from Benfica, he's not doing the numbers next season that Bruno Fernandes is, right? And so,
very expensive too, a lot of money.
Yeah, I know. And so, but that's the type of quality you're going to have to be looking at to talk about Fernandes. I mean, Bruno Fernandes's numbers are absolutely unbelievable, and a United team that is almost impossible to do that in. I'd like to believe that he, you know, and the fact that he's always available is another factor, would not be someone that would be up for grabs. But, you know, when they say that most of these players are up for grabs, it's hard for me to disagree with that. It's hard when I look at that and go, how many would I desperately not want sold? I mean, Christian Eriksen has to be moved on this summer. Christian Eriksen does not have the legs to be played in midfield, and I'm surprised that Ten Hag played him at the weekend, because he's just so slow. And when United were conceding goals early in the season, a significant number of them was because Christian Eriksen was not defending. And you can see he just doesn't have that energy. You know, I think when I look at said, how many of those players would I desperately not want sold? Not many. I mean, how many players in United's team this season would you say are unsellable? I mean, it would be the players that you listed. They obviously have an issue with Marcus Rashford. Now, Marcus has to make his own decisions too. He has to decide what he wants to do. And I mean, I'm not speaking from a position of knowledge here, but I'm sure part of him wants a mental break. I believe in my heart of hearts, Marcus Rashford is a world-class footballer. Yeah, I think people underestimate how important the mental side of this is. And there's obviously, as we've talked about before, things that have gone on behind the scenes that I'm not privileged to say that would honestly, it would give some context to certain things. You know, so for me, I would prefer to see Marcus Rashford stay at United and find his best form and be happy. I look at Maguire. I honestly did not think Harry Maguire would have the season that he had based on where he's been. It's possible. But the right environment also has to exist at the football club too. And, you know, he has to ask himself some really deep questions about what he wants to do. But James, it just goes back to something that I said on social media last week. And I'm not pointing fingers at anyone because I include myself in this. And that professional athletes are human beings. And I have been a prick to people on the internet, not really thinking about the impact on the person on the other side of the screen. Someone that if they were standing in front of me, I would never say that to their face because you see the impact of your words and it would make you feel deeply uncomfortable. You know, it's easy for people to think, oh, he's making all this money, you know, and I worry the things that keep me awake at night. If I had all that money, I wouldn't have any stress. So you wouldn't worry about the things you worry about right now, but you would worry about other stuff. And money, you know, it, once you start getting it on that level, it destroys your family. You know, your second cousins, brothers, you know, they want their wedding paid for. And if it's not, you know, millions of pounds, and if you get your second cousin a Ferrari, it wasn't top of the line. And you see this when people die, right? Money tears families apart. You know, everything that's normal to you and me, they can't do. You know, they can't go out just to, you know, go for a drink with their friends. You know, I mean, I've talked to footballers have told me, you know, they're afraid even to bump into somebody in case they get a sexual assault charge. You know, everything is, you know, it's very, very difficult to do that. And Marcus has zero anonymity. I'm not saying this is what he's going through. I'm just saying that, you know, it's, we have to realize that we've seen with Dele Alli, we've seen other footballers, you know, they're human beings. And I want to see him flourish. I know he loves a football club, and I know his preference would be to stay at United. But I think, honestly, he's in control of his future more than anyone. You know, but I don't think there's a lot of places he realistically could go.
No, I don't think so. And the last kind of point on this as well is that one of the things you don't want to make the mistake of doing here with the change in ownership and a bit of an overhaul or a reset or whatever you'd want to call it is what Chelsea have done. They sold off everybody who had any kind of experience, who had any kind of leadership, who had any kind of, you know, the traits that you see in Bruno and Harry in their times at United, they are valuable. And you miss those things when they're gone, when you don't have people with the kind of experience and ability to kind of front up to criticism, front up to these kind of things that you have, the players who've been there in these positions on the biggest stage and have dealt with it. You know, Chelsea, you look at the team and it's a chaotic mess, and it has been for a while now. They got rid of all their leaders in that locker room, all the experienced players. They've sold them off to other teams, even including Mount to us, who's apparently a very level-headed person, even though he's had injury problems. They don't have any leadership on the pitch, and you can see it. They're sitting fighting over penalties, you know, disastrous type stuff that does derail your season because they have enough talent to be doing way better, and they have no leadership. They have nobody doing it. Thiago Silva is not a good example. His wife sitting there tweeting during games, complaining and making, you know, this is not a workable thing there. So they have nobody, you know, they've sold off players who are doing well elsewhere, like Havertz and all of that. And that doesn't work. Jorginho. And that's something United cannot do. If they're going to reset and build with Garnacho, with Kobbie Mainoo, with Rasmus Højlund, those can't be your senior players. You know, you need people who have experience, who have been there, who have been around a long time to continue to provide some stability in the locker room and on the pitch and to take charge of things. And United are already slightly lacking in that regards, but at least you do have some really positive traits in people like Bruno and Harry Maguire in terms of how they conduct themselves. And I think that it'd be a shame to lose all of those. And even if you've got the best young players in the world, it can throw everything out of balance if you don't have, you know, some experience on the pitch, and it really can have a knock-on effect to the manager as well, having a lot of difficulty getting through to people when you don't have some of that experience. So certainly they shouldn't sell off everybody who's been there for some time just for the sake of it. You know, there's no doubt about that.
All right, let me ask you one or two questions before we leave. What players would you definitely not allow to leave the football club this summer?
I would keep Lissandro because I think what he brings is a talent and something we don't have, you know, and his ability, some of the abilities and traits that he has are fantastic. Obviously the three young ones, I would keep all of them, right? Kobbie Mainoo, Garnacho, Rasmus Højlund. I would keep Diogo Dalot because I think it'd be a huge mistake to let him go. You don't have if he's gone, you don't have a single right back who's competent at the moment. Wan-Bissaka is really struggling. I can't say I would say much beyond that. I can make a case for Onana at the same time. The mistakes can be pretty frustrating. I think you could get a keeper of his quality in, and it's less of an impactful position, I guess, in some respects, or it should be. And then I would keep at least, no matter what, I would keep one of Rashford and Bruno under any circumstances. I would want one of them because they both provide a scoring threat and an attacking threat out of nothing that you historically haven't seen anybody else provide. So I would like to keep both, but I would for sure keep at least one under any and all circumstances this summer.
Yeah, I can't disagree with much more than that. I think, United, Dalot is probably the one fullback out of them all. I mean, I think they have to assume that Luke Shaw will never have another 38-game season. Wan-Bissaka just doesn't have enough quality at this level. I think that if they really want to go for Elise, try to get it back to Palace. In midfield, obviously, Mainoo. Was unsellable. Bruno Fernandes for me is very important. Garnacho, of course. I'd still keep Marcus Rashford. And I know this is going to be controversial. No one agrees. This is just my opinion because I still think, you know, bad players can't have great seasons, but great players can have bad seasons. Yep. And I still think there's a Marcus Rashford on form, head right. He is one player in that United team that pretty much any manager around the world would love to have. I mean, Guardiola loves. Yep. Right, and people can question his commitment and all that. That's up to them. I'm just giving you my opinion that would still like to see him there. I would not sell Højlund either. I think Højlund, has still quite a bit to offer. That's off the top of my head. I can't think of many more. But a big concern with Scott McTominay's injury. So looks they're saying that he will miss the Euros too. Just typical of what's been going on this season. I do think there will be a major clear out this summer. And I think you're looking at maybe 5-6 signings at least. And I'm not talking about a bunch of loans. I'm talking about, important players that are here to make an impact that are a result of proper evaluation and scrutiny. But we shall see, mate. Anything else before we go?
I think that's it. I think that about covers it for today.
Okay, we'll be back again next week, folks. Thanks again to all of you for downloading the podcast, for following us, and for taking my side on the Michael Olise argument.
I think I'm winning that one, to be honest.
Thank you, all of you folks, for all your downloads, likes, retweets, and all that. Much appreciated. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on either one of our platforms and subscribe to our YouTube page. It's the best way you can support the pod. We'll be back again next week. Take it easy, mate. Cheers, Jeffs.
Thanks. See you later.